This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we interview civil rights attorney Jeffrey Robinson, the deputy director of the American Civil Liberties Union, on his talk on the hidden history of slavery in the United States. He'll be giving this talk June 19th at Town Hall in New York City. We'll also talk with attorney Marjorie Hines on her new book, Ironies and Complications of Free Speech. Free speech isn't exactly free speech. We'll learn about that.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
In recent years, our guest, attorney Jeffrey Robinson, has traveled the country speaking about the hidden history of race in America. It's a history, he maintains, that has been stolen from all of us. He'll be speaking on this stolen history on June 19th at Town Hall in New York City. His talk will be the basis for a feature documentary on the history of racism in America. Attorney Robinson is the new deputy director of the American Civil Liberties Union. He graduated from Marquette University and Harvard Law School. He was a criminal defense attorney in Seattle, Washington for 31 years, trying 200 cases to conclusion before he moved to New York City to take up the ACLU position. Attorney Jeffrey Robinson, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jeff, tell us a bit about your background, please. I read that you had tried to conclusion 200 cases. It's amazing that you're here and you're breathing. For one thing, trying a case is like writing a novel, and you don't always win at trials. The power of the government is so awful. When you lose, you dust yourself off and you get back up and you do it again. The only other person that I know that could actually do that was William Kunstler. And we'll talk about that connection in a minute. But please, tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Well, thank you. And I'll start by saying I appreciate the compliment, but I am not in the class with William Kunstler. Very few are. I am a person that knew from about 11 that I was going to be a criminal defense lawyer. I was born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee. And when King was assassinated, I was 11 years old. In the days before he was assassinated, he came to Memphis at the end of March 1968 and led a demonstration that broke into violence. And my father took me to see some of the court hearings because some of the people that were arrested were people that I was brought up to respect. And I saw these lawyers representing people in a courtroom, and I thought, oh my God, how do you get to be one of them? And my dad, who was a high school principal, immediately started in on the, well, you have to go to college, you have to go to law school. And I thought, well, I'll be 25, 26. That's like an old man by then. That's what it feels like when you're 11. But I was on a path pretty much to be a criminal defense lawyer from then. And I graduated from Harvard Law School. I went to Seattle, Washington, and I was a public defender at the state level and then a public defender at the federal level. And then I went into private practice for 27 years doing pretty much 90-95% criminal defense and some civil cases representing plaintiffs who sued either governmental entities or private businesses. And I guess that's how I, or at least in part, what I did before I came to the ACLU.
Well, you've been a public speaker going around the country. And when you speak, you assert that America was founded on the premise of white supremacy and white superiority. How so?
Well, it's a somewhat ugly thing to say and an ugly thing to contemplate because I think, as all of us know, looking in the mirror is a very difficult thing. But I simply go back to the literal origins of Europeans, of white people coming to America and establishing places to live. In 1619, 20 and odd, that's the way they were described, enslaved people were brought to Jamestown. Now, the ultimate statement of white supremacy is that you get to own black people as property. I don't think anybody can dispute that. And that's what was happening in 1619 as the original colonies were being founded. And within the next 20 years, it didn't even take 20, it took about 17, we had built a slave ship called the Desire to go to Africa to get more slaves, more enslaved people, because Americans, white Americans, understood we can get rich this way. The other ships that we sent to Africa, named the Fortune, the Hope, the Prosperity, these were the words that white American settlers associated with the enslavement of black people and owning them as property. By 1662, Virginia passed a law that said, you know what, if an enslaved mother has a child, that child is a slave. Why would that law be necessary? Because the law recognized that white slave masters were raping the black enslaved women, and they wanted to be clear, if any babies come out of those incidents, if they've got freckles or blue eyes, don't go thinking they're human. They're black, they're enslaved, their property. These are just examples of the kind of laws that Americans were passing before the Constitution was even thought of. And then when you go to the Constitution, it gets even uglier.
You say that this history is hidden. Was this done intentionally and purposefully?
It is amazing to me, as I have gone around the country and given these lectures, how many people don't know so many facts about our history. And about 7 years ago, I started to delve into the history of race, and I was feeling angry and ignorant because I started finding facts and detail about exactly how deeply white supremacy ran in the fabric of America, and I was shocked because no one ever taught me. I went to Marquette University and Harvard Law School. Nobody ever taught me this, and I started to wonder, as I discovered it, well, I wonder how many other people don't know these things. So is it intentional or not? I don't know, but I'll give you an example. The state of Texas has had legislators and other quote-unquote leaders suggesting that they should teach that slavery was a side issue in the Civil War. And I guarantee you there are people listening to this who were either taught in high school that slavery was a side issue, or they've got children that are being taught that right now. So Texas officials saying it was a side issue. Here's what Texas said when they withdrew from the Union. All white men are, and of right ought to be, entitled to equal civil and political rights. That the servitude of the African race, as existing in the states, is mutually beneficial to both bond and free, and is abundantly authorized and justified by the experience of mankind and the revealed will of the Almighty Creator. That is white supremacy.
We'll be hearing more from you on June 19th at Town Hall.
I had an amazing experience meeting Sarah and Emily Kunstler, and from meeting them, we have put together a program that will delve into the true history of race in America. And so I'm very excited to be in New York City on Juneteenth and in historic Town Hall Theater there. And there is a project called the WhoWeAreProject.org. And you can go to that website and find out more information. I would just like to invite everybody listening to come join me and others at Town Hall Theater in New York City on Juneteenth, June 19th.
Sarah and Emily are really carrying on their father's traditions and organizing this, and they're going to film it, so it'll be available thereafter. I just remembered one salient point that people probably don't know. Bill Kunstler was Martin Luther King's lawyer.
He was, and in meeting Sarah and Emily, they shared with me a poem that he wrote on April 10, 1968, about 6 days after Dr. King was killed. And it was a very poignant moment. And I have been giving this talk around the country, and last year in May, I gave this talk to some lawyers here in New York City, and Sarah Kunstler happened to be in the audience.
Well, that's how it
came
about.
From there, she called me and said, I'd like to meet. I met with she and her sister, and I thought, I'm really flattered, but this can never happen, and 1 year later, it's going to happen.
That's just terrific, Jeff. You know, I was thinking when I was preparing my notes to interview you, you know, it's just an unending cascade of racist stuff that goes on in this country. I learned yesterday that they're separating non-white babies from their parents on the border. I mean, they wouldn't do that to Norwegians. And then the billionaire owners of the teams in the National Football League, and they're all billionaires except one. The billionaires have told their players, who are mostly black, you're not going to be able to get down on your knee and protest the police murder and abuse of black people. If you don't like it, you can stay in the locker room.
Well, I think it was Yogi Berra who said, it's like deja vu all over again. And the themes that repeat themselves in American history when it comes to dealing with race are impactful and frightening. And the reason that these themes keep repeating themselves, in my view, one of the main reasons is that we have never dealt with our true history of race in America. Americans always talk about accountability, especially in the criminal justice system. If you do something, you've got to be held accountable. Now, there are all kinds of debates going on now, thank goodness, about what true accountability means and how it means something other than locking somebody in a cage, and how we have to think long term about how people can be productive members of our communities. But the issue that keeps coming up is that you have to hold people accountable. Well, America has never been held accountable for the true history of racism in this country. And part of what I believe is that if people were aware of the facts that are hidden, but hidden in plain sight, they would have a different view about what we need to do to get on the right path in this country.
Do you believe that at this moment we're at a tipping point?
I do. In 1968, it seemed to me as an 11-year-old that we were on this incredible path. That was the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. We were getting victories on buses and lunch counters. My parents were excited about what was happening. And then on April 4th, a bullet hit King in the neck, and it just all seemed to roll back. What was happening at that time were young activists were making America take a look at our system of second-class citizenship, segregation, and racism. King was 26 years old when he started in 1955, and he was only 39 when he died. Today, once again, Americans are being forced to look at the realities of racism in America. Once again, that is being led by young activists on the most part. And once again, we are at a point where, despite the current administration, there is momentum on issues of racial and social justice in this country. And the question is, are we going to use that momentum to go forward? Or will we do like we have done time and time again? Will we let it roll back like Sisyphus and come right back down the hill so we have to start pushing all over again?
The Electoral College gave us the presidencies of both Bush and Trump. What's the function of the Electoral College, and why was it set up?
Well, go back to the Constitution, and this is the thing about our history hiding in plain sight. You can go to the archives of the state of Virginia and find out what they were debating when they were talking about whether to approve the Constitution or not. And one of the huge things was the number of slaves in the South. As Patrick Henry said, there were 236,000 enslaved people in the South, in Virginia. And in one of the clauses of the Constitution, the 3/5 compromise, each enslaved person would be counted as 3/5 of a person. And so you then go to the Electoral College and you understand that the reason that many of the southern states have as many electoral votes as they have is that they were able to count enslaved people as not complete people, but 3/5 of a person. And this was intentionally done to appease the South as people were trying to get consensus about the Constitution. I'll tell you one other thing about the Constitution. There are all kinds of provisions in it that deal with slavery, including this one. A provision that says, we will not stop the importation of such persons until 1808. The words such persons was used because the South got indignant when you would use a word like slave or enslaved, and the North didn't want to upset them. The word slave appears once in the Constitution, in the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery. But there's the 3/5 compromise. There's the constitutional provision that says we can keep importing African slaves and making them enslaved people. We can keep doing that until 1808. Then later in the Constitution, it says, hey, remember that provision about 1808? Well, if somebody comes in to amend the Constitution, they can't amend that section until 1808 because we need to keep those ships bringing enslaved people back. In the Constitution, if you are a slave and you run away, there's no freedom. You are to be returned immediately. So there are provisions in the Constitution dealing with enslaved people. And all we have to do is go and look at what the founders of America were talking about.
What kind of wealth did slavery produce in America?
Well, I would suggest for anybody listening to see if you've had this experience. Have you ever held a freshly picked ball of cotton in your hand? I don't mean what you pull out of an aspirin bottle. I mean a freshly picked ball of cotton, no stems, no twigs. And if you've ever held one of those in your hand, you'd understand it weighs practically nothing. By 1790, America was producing 1.5 million pounds of cotton every year from enslaved labor. How could they do that? Because starting with those 20 and odd people in 1619, by 1790, there were 700,000 enslaved people. By 1860, that 700,000 had grown to 4 million. By 1860, the cotton production was 2.3 billion pounds a year. It was 60% of America's exports. The value of enslaved people was greater than every bank, factory, and railroad combined in America. About $3 billion in 1860 money and somewhere between $40 and $100 billion in today's money. That's how America got rich.
So at the end of the Civil War, the demand was made that free black people should be given 40 acres of land and a mule to work it, and this was not done. And why? I mean, what was the consequences of this impoverishment of ex-slaves?
General Sherman's Special Order 15 was to give enslaved people 40 acres. The mule actually came a little bit later, but the idea was to give people a way to start to build their community. And this was not an idea that was foreign in America. In 1830, Andrew Jackson, as President Trump said the other day, I guess we were taming the continent. Andrew Jackson tamed the continent by the Indian Removal Act of 1830, where Native Americans were brushed off of acres of their own land so white settlers could start to build their communities. In 1862, in the middle of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln passes a law that gives 160 acres to white settlers as long as they pay a filing fee and live on the land for 5 years. And over 80 million acres had been distributed by 1900 under those programs. There are economists that say that had black Americans been given 40 acres and a mule in 1865, the value today could have reached the trillions in terms of money that would have been infused into the black community over the past 170 years.
Well, and that didn't happen. And as we know, black people were kept in place after the Civil War by really terrorism and lynching. And lynching has a long history in this country. Please talk about that.
The history of lynching in this country, is unique. And one of the things that I think people should understand is that lynching cannot occur without the involvement or acquiescence of law enforcement. You cannot take a person out of a jail and hang them from a tree in the middle of town without law enforcement knowing about it. And so if you look at the first 10 years of the 20th century, from 1900 to 1910, in each of those years, there were an average of more than one black person every week that was lynched in America. And EJI, organization run by Brian Stevenson, has documented 4,075 racial terror lynchings between 1877 and 1950. So if I do my math pretty quick, that's like 73 years. And so if you do the math there, once again, 73 years, and it's an average of about one black person every week. And there are pictures of these lynchings with American standing and smiling and looking at the camera. Once again, if you think you're going to be prosecuted for a murder, you don't let them take a picture of you and then distribute it as postcards in the community. So there was no question about who was doing these lynchings. The message to black Americans was, don't go thinking that because slavery was abolished that you're really an equal citizen in this country. Don't go thinking that. And we will remind you every week for 73 years.
I've seen some of those postcards. And what's so striking is that they were like picnics. People would bring food. They'd bring their children. It was an event.
And this was teaching people something. It was teaching something to white Americans, and it was teaching something to black Americans as well. This is who we are. People may say, yeah, I knew about lynchings. Did you know how many there were? Did you know about law enforcement involvement in these lynchings? And so people ask, why are black communities so distrustful of law enforcement? And I chuckle and say, really? You have to ask that question? And if you do have to ask that question, honestly, it is because you are unaware of our hidden history of race in this country. And when I say hidden, I want to say again, it is hidden in plain sight. All you have to do is just scratch the surface and you can find it. And so on June 19th, in Town Hall Theater in New York, I invite people to come join us because we are going to scratch the surface and see what's really there.
Yeah, you can just go on the internet, Town Hall, Jeffrey Robinson, June 19th, and they'll tell you how to get there. But let me just go back to one historical question, because I think this is really goes back almost to the root of it. When the Declaration of Independence was written, how many of the people who drafted it were slave owners? The Declaration of Independence.
Well, it's an interesting thing because many people will remember Malcolm X saying something like, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. And when people think about the Declaration of Independence, a moment in this country where the values of freedom, democracy, liberty, equality, these were the values that were motivating people to break away from a world power and form their own country. 41 of the 56 people who signed the Declaration of Independence owned enslaved people. So those words that were written in that historic document were never meant to apply to people who look like me. That is simply a fact. The people who founded this country, who wrote that document, saw nothing inconsistent with claiming to believe in and be willing to die for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and at the same time enslave a whole race of people and own them as chattel. They saw nothing inconsistent with those two things. And that is something we have never accounted for.
Attorney Jeffrey Robinson, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. We'll see you again June 19th at Town Hall in New York City, where we'll continue this discussion. And we wish you every best at your efforts at the ACLU. Keep causing trouble.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. That's what I intend to do.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Free Expression Policy Project was a think tank that delved into the problem of censorship in our society. Until 2017, it was headed up by civil liberties attorney and author Marjorie Hines. The First Amendment ostensibly protects free speech and free expression, but there are exceptions. It also separates church from state, but here too there are exceptions. We speak today with attorney Marjorie Hines about her book. It's called Ironies and Complications of Free Speech, News and Commentary from the Free Expression Policy Project, 2001 to 2017. It's just been published. She's the author of five previous award-winning books, including Priests of Our Democracy, The Supreme Court, Academic Freedom, and The Anti-Communist Purge. She was last on Law and Disorder to talk about that book. Marjorie Hines, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be here.
Marjorie, you were the director of the American Civil Liberties Union Art Censorship Project, and you learned that the primary target of censorship in the United States is the subject of sex. How so?
Well, of course, even way back in law school, we learned that there was something called obscenity, which was an exception to the First Amendment. And when I got to the Art Censorship Project, two of my first cases involved that very subject. One was an obscenity prosecution against a traveling theater company that wanted to present O Calcutta, the old late 60s off-color Broadway musical in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And they said it was obscene. And I went down there and worked with a local lawyer, and we had to persuade the jury by bringing in expert witnesses that this show had serious artistic value and therefore was not obscene. So that was one case. The other case involved an even broader concept than obscenity, called indecency. And this is a standard that the Federal Communications Commission uses to censor broadcast radio and television. That's why we can't say certain words on the radio. And indecency is impossible to define, as is obscenity. But part of it involves community standards, contemporary community standards, which of course is very subjective and gets decided by the FCC commissioners. So there have been some outrageous examples. Martin Scorsese's documentary The Blues was considered indecent by the FCC about 15 years ago because the musicians who were interviewed used a lot of swear words. So lots of examples of FCC censorship of this very broad standard, which also has something to do with sex.
What is obscenity, and why is it assumed to live outside of the First Amendment? I mean, Congress was supposed to have been making a law that doesn't abridge free speech, but that's not totally true, is it?
No, there's lots of exceptions. What is the freedom of speech, and when is it limited? So obscenity has pretty much always been considered by courts and other ruling powers in society to be outside the First Amendment. And this really began in the 19th century, when there were, for a variety of reasons, including more literacy, more urbanization, fears that sexual material, books and pictures, would corrupt the innocent meaning those who were not ruling class males, and therefore couldn't handle this sort of thing, working class people, women and children and teenagers. So obscenity laws became invented. And really, nobody was thinking about the First Amendment as having any kind of application to this. In the early 20th century, the Supreme Court starts looking at the First Amendment and really pretty much assuming that it only applies to political debate. Eventually, that changed. And by the 1950s, the court was acknowledging that, in fact, and I quote from a famous case, sex is a great and mysterious motive force in human life, and therefore a lot of talk about sex should be protected by the First Amendment. But there's still an obscenity exception, and the problem is how to define it, and the court has never succeeded. But in 1973, the Nixon-Berger Court came up with a definition that is still with us. It has three parts. Does the material violate contemporary community standards, whatever that means? Does it appeal to prurient interest, and whatever that means? And does it lack serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value? And that's still the standard today.
Yeah, I remember when I was a teenager, there were books that you couldn't get that I knew about. And Henry Miller had written Tropic of Cancer. That was banned. And my grandmother gave me $20 for my birthday. The ban had just been lifted on Tropic of Cancer, so I got a chance to read that. And then when I got to college, Ulysses, one of the great novels of the 20th century, had been banned also. When I got to college, the ban had been lifted on that. You write about that in your book, Ironies and Complications of Free Speech, just published. You write about the Ulysses ban, and my professors were good enough, once that ban was lifted, to assign it to all of us. And I couldn't believe it that they had banned this book. You know, banned in Boston was the old term.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Ulysses case actually goes back to the 1930s, although at your college or your high school, it may have still been banned, but it couldn't come into the country. Customs yeah. officials would stop it. And so a case was finally brought. And it was one of the major landmarks in early literary censorship law. It didn't get to the Supreme Court, but the federal courts in New York said, this cannot be considered obscene.
So why is stuff about sex not protected by the First Amendment, but racist hate speech is, violent entertainment is okay? How do you explain that?
Well, it's a very good question. And it really comes from, as I mentioned, a 19th century history of puritanical attitudes, fear of corruption from sexual material. And from my point of view, hate speech has a lot more direct, tangible, harmful effects than anything that could ever be proved from sexually explicit speech. And a lot of European countries recognize this and ban incitement to racial hatred or some such form of words. But I'm not advocating that, because the problem is, number one, it's very difficult to define. I mean, there may be a few examples that nobody would disagree about, but for the most part, I mean, there was recently an article, I think, in the New York Times about efforts in Germany to censor anti-Semitic and neo-Nazi kind of music, which is very popular. But a lot of the references are pretty subtle, and you get into very complicated questions. I just went to Othello at Shakespeare in the Park last night. It's a very racist play. So the definitional problem's number one. And number two, it's not effective. There's more, even more racism and anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial and neo-Nazism in Europe than it is, than there is here. You know, violent entertainment, another very good question. And when I began at the Art Censorship Project, this was a big issue. And a lot of very well-meaning liberal groups were trying to restrict, especially minors and teenagers, access to violent entertainment. But and legislation was passed in a lot of states. But again, the definitional problems are overwhelming. You can start with the Bible and go all the way to video games. So no definition was, even if any kind of harm should be proved, and they were relying on some very dubious studies that claimed to show some harm from violent entertainment. But since you can't even define what you're trying to measure, there's really no basis to know what the harm is. And the definitional problems are overwhelming, so that every federal appellate court that has dealt with the issue has struck down these laws trying to restrict extremely violent entertainment, gratuitously violent entertainment, whatever the definition is. And I have an article in the book about that as well.
You write that a major social political justification for censorship in Western culture has long been the notion that minors, including teenagers, must be shielded from arousing images and bad ideas. Well, that seems in our modern culture to really have gone by the boards, hasn't it? What's your view on that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we're sitting in a studio in Midtown Manhattan, but there's a lot of places in the country where that fear is still very prevalent. And it really comes, again, it comes from this notion, and I looked at this when I was at the ACLU and eventually wrote a book about that as well. Fears, myths, and horror stories about masturbation, near universal practice. The fear that boys and young men would sap their vital fluids and suffer harms ranging from pimples to madness, and that girls and young women would get sexually aroused and might not remain virgins until they were married. So the laws, the obscenity laws that we talked about before in the 19th century, were specifically targeted toward the most vulnerable. And the standard was anything that could corrupt the innocence of youth. And it wasn't until the 20th century, in the Ulysses case, was one of the first cases in which judges said, we can't have a standard for all of adult society that turns on what might be considered harmful to youth. But we still have this problem of, you know, overwhelming societal fears about youthful access to pornography, which we know now is easily accessible. And pornography is obviously not the greatest, not appropriate for kids. But there's better ways of sex education than trying to ban it for kids.
You helped run the Free Expression Policy Project. And when you were there, what work did you do that you're most proud of?
Well, the project got started after I left the ACLU. And initially, the focus was on trying to explore this issue of harm to minors, censorship based on fears about kids. And I hooked up with the National Coalition Against Censorship to start this think tank, basically, so we would have resources and debates and policy discussion elsewhere than in these battles in the courts all the time. And very soon, the subject matter got expanded to not only sexual censorship, but issues of corporate media consolidation and how that affects free expression and the information we receive, issues of copyright and fair use. So what am I proudest of? I guess two things. One is the project put out about 6 extensive policy reports, all of which are now on the NCAC, the National Coalition Against Censorship website, on issues ranging from internet filters to copyright and fair use to arts funding. And also just the website that I managed for 16 years and had a lot of information, fact sheets, essays, reviews, news reports that were useful to students especially. And that's part of why I put together the book when I finally faced the fact that one has to move on and it was time to take down the website. I thought some of the news and commentary was really worth preserving. And it's fun also because all of the articles are based on human stories.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading it. Ironies and Complications of Free Speech. Marjorie Hines, what should not have free First Amendment protection?
Okay, well, I guess I would give a two-part answer. First of all, not everything that is speech should be considered part of the First Amendment. For example, if somebody says, I'm not going to hire you because you are black, gay, female, Muslim, that is a speech act. That's an act of discrimination. So forget the First Amendment. Similar example, somebody says, I'm going to break your kneecaps if you don't pay me $10,000. It's threats. It's an act of a threat. It's not protected. But when you get to expression that really is protected, then you've got to do some balancing. And people who say they're First Amendment absolutists and deny that there's any balancing to be done are ignoring reality. So, for example, invasion of privacy, disclosure of highly personal matters causes real tangible harm. I mean, free speech should be the default position, but when the harm is real and tangible, it's okay to have an exception, I think. And I express that in the introduction to the book. Defamation is another example. Willful, malicious, false statements that harm somebody's reputation can really be devastating. Sexual and racial harassment. Again, you've got issues of equality in the workplace and in the schools. And that situation, once you have some limiting definitions to what sexual and racial harassment is, I mean, a nude picture of Michelangelo's David in an art history class may offend some people, but it's not sexual harassment. So if you have a narrow enough definition, I think that the equality principles of the Constitution outweigh the free speech principles.
What are the fundamental values that underlie the First Amendment?
Okay, well, that's one that, as you can imagine, has been written about a lot. And I can give you at least 3 justifications, 3 fundamental values. One is the old proverbial marketplace of ideas, the notion that we need to hear lots of speech from all points of view so that democracy can function, people can make good decisions. Another is the notion of individual rights, the integrity of our own ability to express ourselves, to be creative, and to be different. And another one is the so-called pressure cooker school of First Amendment jurisprudence, which posits that if you let people let off steam, society will be more stable. There's going to be less likelihood of violent rebellion. And as for me, I'm a little dubious about the marketplace of ideas because I don't think a market is the best way to actually get all the opinions out there. But I would go with the second, with number 2, the integrity of the individual.
Let's talk about copyright control, which is a subject that bothers me, particularly when you hear that stuff has been tied up for dozens and dozens of years and doesn't get out to the public. Are you for more or less copyright control?
I'm for less, and here's why. I mean, you're absolutely right that initially the copyright clause of the Constitution was intended to create a monopoly for authors and inventors and artists for a very brief period of time, 14 years. After that, everything would be in the public domain and free to be copied and used and distributed. So a temporary monopoly that allowed people to get compensation. That has now been extended, and I have a piece in the book about what we call the Mickey Mouse Law, because over the two centuries of the American Republic, the extension of copyright control has been extended and extended and extended. And the Mickey Mouse Law in the late 1990s, it's actually called the Sonny Bono Copyright Protection Act, because Sonny Bono was a member of Congress briefly. And Mickey Mouse was about to enter the public domain. The time of copyright was already almost 100 years. And Walt Disney did not want Mickey Mouse to enter the public domain. So it was extended again another 20 years. So we now have life of the author plus 70 years. And for corporations, it's even more than that. I think it's 90 now. So the public domain has basically disappeared, except for very old works. And authors and artists are really on both sides of this issue, because they want to profit from, they want to make a living from their works. But on the other hand, they also are constantly borrowing, quoting. Everything builds on something else in the world of creativity. So what we have, I mean, the reason I say less is that what we have now really is an overwhelming, powerful control of copyright by big media corporations. And they are overzealous in their insistence on control, so that, for example, the wonderful civil rights documentary, Eyes on the Prize, was out of circulation, I think still is out of circulation, for many, many years because the filmmakers did not have deep pockets, and they had to pay for using archival footage of civil rights protests, civil rights songs. And if copyright control hadn't been so strict, or if they were able to benefit from a doctrine called fair use, which we can talk about, that wonderful documentary would not have been suppressed.
I did want to talk about fair use. I think that's an important concept. But I was reminded when you were talking about a predicament that my son Eli Smith got into. There was an anthology of an American folk music compiled by a guy from Greenwich Village named Harry Smith. And it was put out in the early 50s, and it became really like the Bible for people like Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and that whole generation that revivified American folk music. So Eli and his friend John Cohen got the idea that they would republish the anthology, but they'd put out the B-sides of all these old records that Harry Smith had compiled. And you know, they were prevented from doing so because they found out that Sony, a Japanese corporation, owned all the copyrights to this old American music going all the way back 100 or more years. And this Japanese corporation wouldn't let Eli and John publish American music for American people. And hopefully it's going to come out soon, but they were fighting about that for several years.
Which brings us to fair use.
That's why I raised the anecdote. What do you think about the doctrine of fair use?
The example you gave of your son is a fairly tricky one, but fair use is probably the most important what we call free expression safety valve in copyright law. I mean, if it wasn't in the copyright law, the courts would have had to invent it, because it gives everybody the right to use, without asking permission or paying sometimes exorbitant fees, to copy, to quote, to riff off, to make parodies of works that are copyrighted for purposes of scholarship, teaching, commentary and criticism, including parodies, and news reporting. So it allows uses within reason. The problem is there is no specific definition, and the copyright industry, the large media corporations, tend to be overzealous. They don't like fair use, so they send threatening cease and desist letters, they send takedown notices to websites, and the penalties for copyright infringement can be severe. And often those who are on the other side, the scholars, the teachers, the commentators, the news reporters, do not have the deep pockets to fight these things in court.
Marjorie Hines, we're coming to an end to our allotted time. I want to remind our listeners that you are the author of a just-released book, Ironies and Complications of Free Speech, a very fine book. But I wanted to end by asking you your thoughts on a current problem. The billionaire owners of the various teams that make up the National Football League, and they're billionaires, you know, there's only one that's not. And they issued an edict last week telling their players that they cannot protest police brutality, police murder on the field by taking a knee. If they keep their mouths shut, and if they don't like it, they can stay in the locker room. Why are they able to get away with that?
They're able to get away with it legally because they're not the government, and the First Amendment only restricts the government's ability to censor. But there are laws in every state that govern terms of employment, and it may be that in some states the players could in fact raise a claim that this kind of coercion, this kind of condition on employment is simply in violation of state law. So there's various theories that might be used. To get away from the legal stuff for a minute, they shouldn't be able to get away with it as a matter of public opinion, and hopefully they won't. Hopefully the fans will tell them to back off.
Well, it's been a really fine interview. Before we're forced to say goodbye, Marjorie, do you have any final thoughts on the question of free speech as it exists today in the land of Trump?
I'm just reminded of a couple of pieces in the book, and we were talking about copyright before. It wasn't an issue I expected to be part of a free expression policy project, but it turned out to be. And some of my favorite pieces in the book are about Google's attempt to control the use of the verb to Google, believe it or not. They sent out cease and desist letters telling what were legitimate uses of the word Google and what were not. Of course, they failed. In the era of Trump, there's a lot of books coming out, a lot of arguments coming out about how we need to limit free speech because of all the fake news and all the lies, the daily cascade of lies that we're getting. And I can understand the impulse behind that. But again, I think we have to be very careful. And there are, I mentioned defamation laws before, there are some limitations that the law allows on malicious lies that harm reputation. So that's one way. I think there is now a defamation lawsuit being brought by Stormy Daniels against Donald Trump. So there's some leeway within the law to try to address this big, big problem.
Marjorie Hines, the author of Ironies and Complications of Free Speech, thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Thank you, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
met each other this morning for a reason. Thinking, talking, we've worked out our problems. Look like we should have better days in front. Just because we took our time to think and talk for a much better understanding.